You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality.
A new spodcast at last. Hello and welcome to a podcast of spurious morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week again, I have Greg.
A new body. Oh, you already did that joke. Never.
Yeah, I've already done that one. Yeah, and I have Jimmy.
Hello.
See, I was hoping you'd say something else so I could go, a new joke at last.
Sorry, I should have set you up better, I guess.
So, as you may have gathered, we are looking at the second half of season 18, or we're sort of doing it in slightly uneven halves, but we're looking at the last few stories, the ones we didn't get to do in part one. We're also going to take a bit of time to look back at Romana and K-9 as they leave after Warrior's Gate, and we are, of course, going to look at Tom Baker's era, or eras, I suppose you could argue, as the Doctor, as he departs in Legopolis. So quite a bit to talk about in this one. I'm looking forward to it, though. As established last time, I'm a big, big fan of season 18. You know, we've already discussed some fantastic stories. I think we all kind of agreed that State of Decay's pretty damn difficult to beat. But I think the run of quality has been pretty good all the way through so far. So let's dive straight in. We're going to pick up where we left off, which is Warrior's Gate. And I believe the season did actually have a break when it was originally broadcast between State of Decay and Warrior's Gate. I think it had a month off for Christmas. So we've had the same break as the Doctor did. Warrior's Gate, then, is a bit of a weird story. I think it's certainly one that... No, it's not one that people don't understand. It's one that people need to watch and pay attention to and maybe give a few goes to. I think instinctively a lot of people could kind of look at it and go, no, don't like that one, weakest of the season, which I found quite surprising, actually, while watching the Behind the Sofa on the Blu-ray. Everyone kind of went, no, not too keen on that one, not sure. I think really, though, you have to watch Warrior's Gate very closely, very carefully. And I think, it does take a few goes. I think there's an absolutely brilliant story in there, but it's not one that's as immediately evident as it is in some other stories. It's doing something different. It's doing something clever. And it's Doctor Who being pretty high concept. In fact, it's probably the most high concept story we've discussed so far. You're more than welcome to disagree with me there, of course, but I'm struggling to think of anything that we've had previously that quite asks the audience to bear with it as much as Warrior's Gate does. So arguably an impenetrable story, certainly on the first go, but I think it's definitely one that rewards someone who watches it closely, pays attention to it, and is open to not necessarily having the whole story told to them straight off. This is probably a similar discussion we'll have when we get to 26 and we talk about Ghostlight as well, but I think it's all there. I just think it's a bit of a jigsaw you need to throw together. So Greg, talk to us about Warrior's Gate.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's not an easy story to, you know, get your head around. It's definitely something that rewards rewatching. I mean, certainly the second or third time you see it, it just makes a lot more sense than the first time, which isn't great because, of course, back then you didn't have reruns, you didn't have home video, so there was no way to watch it a second time. But as you know, right now you can, and like you said, the story works. I mean, it does hold together. It does make sense. Not everything is explained, and that's fine. You don't have to explain everything. There's a lot of abstract imagery. There's a lot of metaphor on display. It's interesting too that you mentioned the behind the sofa, you know, and the group not caring for it. I think that was the second Blu-ray set, I think, maybe the third. And I don't think they'd really figured out how to edit the stories down like they do for Behind the Sofa, because like they were talking and like missing huge chunks of the plot. Like I think Janet Fielding says they never saw Adric, who is, of course, in the story. So I just wonder, you know, if they even got something that was understandable put in front of them. But for me, it's very good. What really stands out even more than the abstract nature of the script and the imagery is the directing by Paul Joyce, which is some of the most innovative that the classic series ever had, maybe the most innovative. Certainly hard to think of too many stories that are directed this well, short of like Androzani and, you know, maybe a couple of the later McCoy stories. But I mean, This is something where he takes these studio cameras, which are just these massive things, and uses them almost like handheld cameras. They make these crash zooms, these big sweeping movements of the cameras. Like this had to be so intricately blocked to get that to work. And it really does work well. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a beautiful story to watch. I think, you know, I really like Romana in this story. I mean, it's her last, and while I think her departure is very abrupt and, you know, kind of unrewarding, I think it's a great story for her, because what it does do is it shows her like kind of taking on the mantle of the doctor for E-Space and operating on her own for most of it, and, you know, having the getting into trouble, of course, but for the most part, having the crew of the ship wrapped around her finger, you know, like she's very impactful here and demonstrates why she'll be able to, you know, go out and do that. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, earlier that they didn't have Adric in the edit for Behind the Sofa, and that's because Adric doesn't do anything in the story other than wander around, so fair enough. Tom is very somber, of course, as he's getting near the end, but great as usual. It's an interesting story for K-9. You know, his last story, he's mostly just babbling gibberish, but there's a lot of, you know, interesting stuff he's saying, like about the I Ching and so forth. You know, it's impenetrable enough that it's never going to be like my favorite story. Like, I don't think Doctor Who is at its absolute strongest when it's doing something this abstract, but it's really, really good. I mean, this would be the standout in multiple seasons, and here, just because of the quality, it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. It's in the middle. It's a very good story. I agree with you that there's always going to be a point where it sort of alienates its audience enough to not be beloved. But it's not a bad story, not by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's definitely a good one. Just one point I'll make about Adric is I agree with you. Adric doesn't really do much in this, and I can completely understand him not making it into the Behind the Sofa edit until the last scene. But there are some absolutely brilliant moments between Adric and K-9 in this. I know K-9's not 100%, but you get to see sort of hints of a relationship that we never quite got, because obviously K-9 leaves with Romana at the end of this. But it's quite nice, you know, K-9 refers to Adric as young master and that kind of thing. There are just some little standout moments between the two, and it's kind of a shame that we never got more of a crossover between them, really. But it's just a few nice little moments in there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think you said, like, with that, I think Matthew Waterhouse has said this too. I think Adric works the best, like, in this setting with the Fourth Doctor and Romana and K-9. Like, he really works well as, you know, this, like, you know, child student character, you know, and obviously that kind of goes away when the Fifth Doctor era comes in. That's an interesting dynamic too, but yeah, I agree with you. I could have had a whole season with this specific group.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame that really all we get is, I mean, we don't even really get three stories. It's kind of two and a half stories, because Adric doesn't do anything for certainly the first half of State of Decay apart from eat. But yeah, I agree with you that it's a shame there isn't more of this TARDIS team. And I'm really glad that Big Finish have managed to expand on that with that one series of the Fourth Doctor Adventures. And again, there's some brilliant Adric and K-9 stuff in there. And it plays, I mean, this Warrior's Gate more than anything else, I suppose, sort of talking about Romana kind of becoming the Doctor almost. It's almost like Romana is the Doctor's companion and Adric is Romana's companion. And that works quite nicely as well at points. Anyway, Jimmy, talk to us about Warrior's Gate.
Oh, gosh. I'm not going to be agreeing with much of what you said. I absolutely hated it. I'm sorry. I thought it was boring, overrated, things weren't explained and didn't make sense. I mean, about the only thing I did like was at the end when Adric got and the Doctor got the line about, will Romana be all right? Oh, she'll be superb. And that was a good, you know, cap to her era. But that was about all I liked. It just was so rubbish. Like, the White Void doesn't even look as good as, like, in the 60s when they tried it with Mind Lover. And the whole, okay, this is the bridge between the two universes. Oh, but it's a universe of its own. Oh, it's in black and white for some reason. Oh, they're going to take you back in time and show you the Thrills when they were dominating. But, oh, is the Doctor actually there or not there? It doesn't get explained. And every 2 minutes, oh, the journey's getting shorter this time. Oh, the journey's getting shorter this time. Oh, the journey's getting shorter this time. Oh, I absolutely hate this one. It's definitely the worst Tom Baker story, in my opinion. And, yeah, so it's so dragged out, it feels like it goes forever. I mean, it's between that and the overrated and the boring, I'd call it the classic series equivalent of Heaven Sent, which is another one that I, don't enjoy at all. Yeah, sorry, this one just wasn't for me. Other than that last line saying goodbye to Romana, that was about the only thing in the whole story I actually liked.
You know, I agree with you. I think it is the classic series equivalent of Heaven Sent. That's a great comparison. I just don't think we're agreeing for the same reason.
Everyone seems to love that one, but that's, I hate it. I'd put it in the bottom four of the entire series.
I can totally see why somebody wouldn't gel with this story, though. Like, it is slow. It is repetitive. I think there's an awful lot going on there if you look for it. And if you like what you look for, then obviously, there's something to be found from this. But again, I can completely understand how somebody would watch this and just think, what the hell have I just done with 90 minutes? It's an odd story, and I think it's always going to be contentious. I don't think fandom's ever going to have a consensus on this one. I think, you know, we settle down and we agree on certain things. And as the years have gone by, we've started to recognize other stories as better and others as worse and da, 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 da. I don't think there's ever going to be a universal truth for Warrior's Gate. I think it's always going to be a bit of a disputed piece. And, you know, maybe that's testament to what it is trying to do, I guess. But as we've said, Romana and K-9 do leave at the end of this one. And while it's a very abrupt exit, I mean, it's about as abrupt as Leela's was and various others that we've had, I think it's good. It doesn't stand out in the sort of list of bad companion exits for me. It's rushed, and it's a shame that K-9's pretty much just a prop at the, you know, he doesn't say goodbye to the Doctor. He doesn't get a chance to, but it works really well, like Romana making that snap decision to go, well, hang on a minute, I can do some good here. I can be the Doctor. I can take everything I've learned and I don't have to go back to Gallifrey. And of course, that was kind of seeded a few stories ago. It makes sense that that's what Romana does. Certainly more sense than Leela deciding to marry the first bloke she met on Gallifrey. But Yeah, I think it works well. I think it's a good exit. And I think it's kind of a shame that we're losing these characters at this point. Like John Nathan Turner, obviously, you know, wanted Rid, wanted to establish his own TARDIS team. And fair enough, fine. But I think it's a shame to lose Romana so close to the end of Tom Baker's era. And sometimes it feels like the Fourth Doctor's era ends here, like leaving eSpace, and the two stories that follow are just kind of the epilogue about how this Doctor dies. But this genuinely does sort of feel like the end of the era, because K-9 has been there for the majority of the Fourth Doctor's run. Romana's done, what, 3¾ series at this point? Sorry, 2¾ series. And yeah, there's just this sense that the Fourth Doctor's universe is falling apart, and I quite like it. It just adds to that foreboding sense that we've had throughout the whole season, which has definitely ramped up in this one, I think, and will ramp up even more over the following two stories. So any sort of final words you guys want to make on Romana and K-9 and their exit and their impact on the era? Anything you want, really. Greg, you go first.
Well, I think we talked about Mary Tam's Romana back after the Key to Time season, but you know, I absolutely adore Lala Ward as Romana. I think she's one of the best companions of the classic series, because the show actually leaned into the dynamic of having two Time Lords in the TARDIS. Like, character development, quote unquote, is something you don't see a lot of, you know, very deliberately in the show. But at least, like, here, Romana's background is constantly acknowledged. Like, she's, you know, intellectually superior to most of the people they meet, but, you know, not to the Doctor, and especially doesn't have the Doctor's, you know, cunning and common sense and so forth. And she's more developed once she regenerates into Lala Ward, but still she's learning throughout. And I think Warrior's Gate, like I said, is a great exit for her, insofar as it shows her really reaching that, you know, apotheosis, so to speak, you know, becoming the Doctor of eSpace. And I mean, she's missed for sure. I mean, I think for the Bidmead era, because it's so high concept, because it uses so much, you know, scientific terminology, like having your two lead characters be Time Lords is great. And then having, you know, Adric as the third as a mathematical genius is, you know, appropriate. And then K-9 is a brilliant, you know, robot. So that works. But then, you know, when you switch it around for season 19, you know, Peter Davison, as great as he is, isn't, you know, as good at the abstract, you know, science fiction-y stuff as Tom is. And, you know, and this is au fait with that kind of thing, but, you know, it just kind of drifts away from it. And it doesn't, the Bidmead thing doesn't really sit as well for me in season 19. I think it's perfect here in season 18 because of, you know, the regular characters that you have. And then K-9, I mean, what can I say? I love K-9. K-9's my favorite. He's hilarious. He's smart. Like, there's so many great moments where, you know, someone gives him a compliment and he says, you know, your thanks are unnecessary, but you see his tail wagging. It's just, he's absolutely adorable. And even in season 17, when he has the, you know, the weird David Brierley voice, like, even then, like, he's very funny. And yeah, K-9 doesn't do a lot. Like, he's mostly there as a plot device and comic relief, but John Leeson is so endearing, and the way that they, you know, use the prop is so endearing. K-9's maybe my favorite companion, I'll just say it. I love K-9. So this is, yeah, really an end of the era for me too, because, like, man, it gets real different real quick.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I find it really difficult to imagine a season 19 or even Peter Davison's Doctor with K-9, there's something about him that just works so well with Tom Baker. And I don't quite know what it is because, you know, Tom Baker's openly said he's not the biggest fan of K-9, and there's, you know, studio footage of him kicking the prop and telling it to F off and all this kind of thing. So they do seem to work so well together, though, like this sort of fairly literal robot dog, but definitely with its personality, and the Fourth Doctor just being the huge character the Fourth Doctor is. It works really well. So in some ways, I think it may be for the best that K-9 has gone and has just become so intrinsic to the Fourth Doctor's era. I know, you know, K-9's had some on-screen stuff with other Doctors and some Big Finish stuff with other Doctors, but I think ultimately, I don't think he would work with another Doctor. I think he just works so well as Tom's companion. Yeah. Jimmy, do you want to talk to us about Romana and K-9?
Yeah, to start with K-9, I think absolutely brilliant character, and it's great that he was around for so long. But I think, like you say, he works really well with his dynamic with Tom and with Leela and with both the Romanas. I think, like, as you say, he wouldn't work as well later. I mean, he comes back, sure, but Tom's his main Doctor, and yeah, I think he left at the right time, so I'm glad it worked out the way it did. And as for Romana, yeah, both the Romanas are brilliant. I do slightly prefer the first, but Leela does an incredible job throughout, and especially in some stories like Hornsnaimon from the last season, where she's the one that sort of is actually getting her teeth into it and taking it seriously when no one else is. And yeah, she definitely fulfilled the companion role brilliantly. And yeah, it's a shame she had to go, but again, I think it works well that she leaves before Tom and that we get that last little chance to see him with a new team and all that. So yeah, and the other thing I find ironic is the whole most of this season, she's just been like, oh, I don't want to go back to Gallifrey. Oh, why would I go to Gallifrey? Oh, don't take me to Gallifrey, please. And then you get in the extended universe and it's like, here's Romana, happily the president of Gallifrey. It just seems weird, but I mean, sure, you can argue a lot of times past and character development off screen, but it just, yeah, it's funny that everyone decided, yep, she's got to go back to Gallifrey, when the whole of her last season was her talking about how much she didn't want to.
I'm glad that that's what they did, though, because I do love the Gallifrey audios and, you know, the fact that Romana's still out there and all that kind of thing. I think
absolutely.
It's allowed.
I love it.
It's allowed for some brilliant storytelling. But yeah, it's. I know what you mean. It does kind of contradict the last thing we see on the screen from her. But yeah, really, really good couple of characters, and it's okay. Two, you know, we've had two incarnations of Romana, but you know, if we take Romana as the same character, we take the Doctor as the same character, so we should. This is, you know, this is a very, very sort of strong, consistent, long-running TARDIS team that's just starting to break down now, and will, you know, break down even further in the next few episodes. So let's move on to the Keeper of Traken, which I think's excellent. I think it's just another really, really good story. I think it's arguably one that gets lost because of the season it's in. You know, it's, you know, when we were talking about favourite episodes, we talked about State of Decay, we talked about Legopolis. We didn't really talk about Keeper of Traken, but I think it's pretty damn excellent in its own right. It's just surrounded by absolutely wonderful, brilliant Doctor Who. And it's because it's sort of the penultimate story and it's a little bit of a prologue to Legopolis and all that kind of thing, it maybe just gets missed off a tiny little bit. But it's a great story. It's full of great concepts. It really takes the whole season 18 sort of idea of systems breaking down and takes it to quite an interesting place. You know, it's a society that gets by on people being nice to each other, to quote the episode itself, and how that all starts to fall apart because of this fairly vague idea of an evil creature. And I know that evil creature turns out to be the Master in disguise, but the expanded universe has kind of gone on to discuss the Melka as their own thing and what they are and that. So yeah, it's quite interesting how basically the Master sits in his TARDIS, plays the long game, and just allows this society to break down in the way that it does. Treemas is an absolutely brilliant character. I think the whole Master taking over his body thing works so well because he's such a likable character throughout this story. You know, he's the good character, and the point is he's a good character. And yeah, it's a great performance, and I can see why they kind of went with the idea of making Anthony Ainley the Master, because his performance here as Treemas is just so different to anything he does as the Master, and it's really well played over this and Legopolis and Castrovalva as well. You know, I quite like that we have this little Master trilogy to carry us over. So yeah, I think this is a fantastic story. It's perhaps a little bit more low key. It's not full of action set pieces. There's a lot of conversation, but it's gripping. It's good Doctor Who, and that's, you know, it stands up in a season of excellence. So Greg, talk to us about Keeper Draken.
I like this story because of the things you described, really, how it's set, you know, in this kind of odd space between Warrior's Gate and Legopolis, how it, if we exclude Mission to the Unknown, which was kind of its own weird thing driven by necessity, this is really the first time that one story has so strongly been connected to another one. Not in terms of like, yeah, I mean, Curse of Peladon and Monster of Peladon both go to Peladon, and, you know, one references things that happened in the other, but they're several seasons apart. They're not really related that closely. Here, this everything that happens in this story flows directly into Legopolis, and that is not something that Doctor Who is in the habit of doing. Like, the individual stories are always very discrete elements, and this is a rare case when they're not, when they're connected. And I think that's a good thing, because on its own, you know, there isn't a great deal that actually happens in this story. I mean, we learn very quickly, you know, what the conflict is when the Keeper shows up in the TARDIS, and then most of the story is just various groups of characters wandering between various rooms and being captured and recaptured. Like, there's a lot of padding here, but the atmosphere of it, and I'm going to say this again for Legopolis, by the way, the atmosphere of it is so nice. Like, there's this peaceful, tranquil atmosphere, but there's this, like, you know, this subtle sense of something being wrong. You know, it really embraces the entropy theme. Like, this is, you know, an ancient, well-organized, you know, near-perfect society that is now being eaten away from within. I think what you see here, this is really the only Tom and Adric, you know, solo story, and I think the two of them work very well together. And I mean, obviously, like I said just a minute ago, I think Adric's best with the whole, you know, the Dr. Romana canine thing, but just him and the Fourth Doctor on their own really work well too. And I know Matthew Waterhouse loved that and has always said he wished he could have had more just with him and Tom. I know Tom doesn't agree with that necessarily, but I think that works well. And there's so much about this story that just wrong-foots you, you know, like, I mean, it's explicitly setting Nyssa up to be the new companion. I mean, you know, it's the very, you know, traditional thing of, you know, she's kind of introduced on the periphery in the first episode, but she becomes more and more involved. She spends a lot more time with the Doctor. She and Adric develop like a very like pleasant relationship with each other. Like, you know, and of course she's a young woman, right? So, you know, clearly this person's going to be getting in the TARDIS at the end of the story, but then she doesn't. And then, you know, her father is, you know, taken over by the Master and disappears. And the last image of the story is her saying father and looking around. And it's like, wait a minute, none of that was supposed to happen. Like, what's wrong here? And that's really like the point of this. I think the point of this story is to like show you something that's perfect and then make it increasingly uncomfortable. and then throw you right into Tom Baker's final story. And I think it works incredibly well. And like you said, Anthony Ainley is phenomenal in this. You know, he's a stagey kind of performer. Like he's definitely, you know, he's got the booming voice. He's always, you know, playing to the camera a little bit, but it works, you know, because he really takes different angles to that approach, like with Tremas and then with the Master. And, he's great. And, you know, Jeffrey Beavers, of course, has become maybe the definitive Big Finish master, but his performance here, which is almost all voice, is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, he is one of the best evil voices that Doctor Who has ever had. And I'm so happy we got to hear so much more of his master on audio, because he's great. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just taken on its own, just as a discrete piece of TV, this is good. I wouldn't say that it's great, but as like essentially the first four episodes of like the final eight parts of, you know, Tom Baker and the 12 parts of, you know, considering Castrovalva as well, I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of sense of, I guess, the calm before the storm with Keeper of Draken. Not that it's very calm, because as you say, you know, a lot of very unpleasant stuff happens. I quite like the fact that it sort of foreshadows the Master getting one over on the Doctor. Like, the Master not only survives this, he manages to take over the body of the Doctor's friend and all that kind of thing. It really is kind of showing us four episodes early that the Master can and will defeat the Doctor. He was absolutely the right character to bring back. I know that Bidmead's been fairly critical of the idea, but actually I think the Master was the right character to do this sort of big, epic Doctor regeneration storyline with.
I agree with that. And I think what really works too is the fact that we see the Master loses, right? The Doctor defeats him. You know, the last thing we see is he's inside the Melker/TARDIS, whatever's going on there, and everything's on fire and he's screaming and it's falling apart. And you're like, ah, yes, all right, we have defeated the Master again. And, you know, maybe we'll see him again in a few years. And then he shows up again and, you know, as you said, kills the Doctor's friend and escapes. And you're like, oh, wait, that's not right either. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very deliberately foreshadowing, yes.
And very well. Very well done. Jimmy, talk to us about Keeper of Draken.
Yeah, I absolutely love this one. If it weren't for State of Decay, this would be my next favourite of the season. The whole fairy tale vibe with the opening episode and the narration of the history of Draken and what it is, it's just such an interesting opening, and it's not the sort of style that the stories are usually doing at this time, and it feels quite a contrast to the rest of how most of season 18 is very science-y. And yet here you've got this fairy tale society with, you know, the magical keeper telling you its history. I think it makes a great contrast. And also on that first scene, I love the dynamic between Four and Adric. I mean, as you both said, they work so well as a pairing without any other companions around. It would have been nice to have been able to get a bit more of that. But, I mean, what we do get is brilliant. And, yeah, it's good to see. And, again, Ainley is brilliant at playing Tremas, and it's – especially with the hindsight when we're always used to seeing him as the Master, just seeing him play a good guy is such a different thing, but he plays it really well. And especially in the scene, and again, Jeffrey Beavers here too, the scene where the Master controls Tremas into killing Neiman and then Millie himself, they play it perfectly. Like, Ainley's face is just like paralyzed, stunned, horrified, but not moving, and just picking up the gun and tilting his arm back without looking to shoot Neiman. Like, just like completely out of control, and then just putting it to his own head. It's just brilliantly creepy, brilliantly performed. I love that scene. It's so good. And yeah, it's Beavers as well. He's, as you both say again, brilliant from the very start. And yeah, it's such a good thing that Big Finish ended up using him so much, because it would have been a shame if he'd only been in this one story. But these days he's an iconic Master himself, like Delgado or Missy or whoever. He has his own brilliant incarnation, and I'm glad that happened. And the other thing I really like was Missa usually, especially later, she usually gets the more passive background sort of role, but here she makes her own little blaster and zaps the guards to go and rescue them, and it's like, yeah, that's pretty good. Missa's actually getting to be badass, and it's a shame you didn't get much more of that. I mean, she does again in Arc of Infinity, I think, but other than that, she's not usually like that. But, yeah, it makes a great contrast seeing her being so proactive and tough. And, yeah, what else? Also, I love the Doctor's line later in the story about, don't listen to me, I never do. It's just such a Doctor-y thing for him to say. And, of course, the Hartnell fan in me loves that the actress who played Kanaika got to come back, but it's a shame she got such a small role and didn't get to do much as Keturah. That always nice to see little things coming back from that era for me. So, yeah, absolutely love this one. Not a bad thing to say about it at all, really. It's just brilliant.
It's certainly a near enough faultless story. Just not much happens in it, but because of, you know, as Greg said, it's essentially the first four parts of a 12-part story almost. And as a result, I'm fine with that kind of slight drop in pace. And it's not a drop in pace, actually. After Warrior's Gate, it's quite pacey. But, yeah, I just going back to what you said, Jimmy, that sort of narrative device of using the TARDIS screen, the Keeper, to tell, basically do the world building. You know, Trakan's a very, very well-built world in, you know, by Doctor Who standards. How many planets and societies are as well established as Trakan is in this story? You know, Peladon gets a pretty good go, but I'd struggle to think of many others. So yeah, I really like that. I like the fact that this story takes its time telling you about the place that the Doctor and Adric are going to visit, and you know, the what the ideas behind the society are. And I need to re-listen to Primeval, which is the Big Finish that kind of revisits Trakan at an earlier stage. But yeah, I like the fact that we spend a lot of time learning about Trakan and building it up and understanding how it works as a society. And then, of course, it just gets blown away in Legopolis, which leads to a absolutely fantastic moment with Nyssa that unfortunately kind of gets dropped and not particularly mentioned much again on screen. Yeah, Keeper Trakan's wonderful, and I'm really, really glad that it is, as I said before, this sort of calm before the storm of Legopolis. So let's move on to Legopolis. Let's head over to that. So this story had a lot to do. You know, we've got the pieces to pick up from Trakan. You know, Nyssa does need to become established as a companion. She was a fantastic one-off character, but, you know, she's got to come back and come and be a companion, as we know she did. It's got to give Adric something to do. It's got to introduce Tegan, which I think it does very, very well. And obviously we've got the big showdown between the Fourth Doctor and this new rejuvenated master. That's a lot of stuff to fit into sort of 90, 100 minutes. And I think it does it very, very well. Like, Legopolis can feel slow. There's an awful lot of wandering around the TARDIS. There's an awful lot of measuring another police box. And we spend a bit of time wandering around Legopolis. But it's all there. It's a big, epic story that just kind of starts as the Doctor wanting to fix the TARDIS and turns into this big universe-sized threat. And for once in Doctor Who, and I really mean this, for once in classic Doctor Who, it really feels as though the entire universe is on the line. It really feels as though the threat is that scale. There's an awful lot of, oh, that'll destroy the universe, and then, you know, nothing really coming of it. Whereas with this, like, we see big, big chunks of space just being wiped out by what's going on. It ties so brilliantly back to the E-Space trilogy and obviously Trakan as well. This really is the culmination of just such an excellently thought-out planned season. This is a better season finale, conclusion to a storyline, whatever you want to say, than The Key to Time, which did have, you know, its ongoing story throughout the series. Legopolis and season 18, the storyline is much more subtle. There are just you know, little bits here and there drop throughout the series that kind of all get pulled together in Legopolis. But the way it does it is far, far better than bringing the Black Guardian up on the TARDIS scanner for 5 minutes at the end. I could rattle on about how much I love Legopolis for ages. You know, it just the mood, the music, the atmosphere. Tom's performance is something else. And I'm glad we do get two episodes, or an episode and a half at least, of just the Fourth Doctor and Adric again before sort of Tegan and Nyssa get brought in. Perhaps the only clunky thing is the way Nyssa's introduced. She turns up and goes, oh, a friend of the Doctor's brought me, you know, blind the Watcher. But we don't really know how the Watcher communicates with Nyssa. Like, he doesn't communicate with anybody, really. I think he has a bit of an off-screen chat with Adric at one point, if I remember correctly. But yeah, apart from Nyssa's there now, I really can't find a problem with this story. And I think it is the perfect way for the Fourth Doctor to go out, you know, a big saving the entire universe type thing, beating the Master, who still escapes at the end, same as Draken. He's got one over on the Doctor. He escapes. It's an extra little sort of stab in the eye after him causing the regeneration. Great story. Fantastic story. I could, like I say, go on about it all day, but I'm going to let you guys have a go instead. So, Greg, go for it. Talk about Legopolis.
Again, I do agree that there are flaws with Legopolis, and I'm going to get this out of the way. I mean, it is very slow in parts. It is very high concept, very intellectual. There's lots of conversations about mathematics, and it's overstuffed in some ways. Like, I love Tegan. I love Janet Fielding. I'm very happy she was added to the TARDIS crew, but I don't think she really fits in this story. You know, I think having a character who's as naturally, you know, loud and confrontational as she is can be a, you know, a great thing, and is a great thing in the future. But I feel like she just clashes with the very otherwise downbeat feeling of the story, and I don't think she fits in very well. But again, happy we have her. Just I'm not a big fan of this story being her intro story, especially because you also have to then reintroduce Nyssa and, you know, establish her as a companion as well. And so that leads to things like, you know, Nyssa watches her entire civilization be wiped from existence. And I mean, Sarah Sutton's really good in that one scene where she's devastated, but then it never comes up again. It's like, oh, okay. Because they just have so much to get through, like you said. All of those flaws are there. I can fully understand why someone could point at those and say, I don't like this story. This is one of my favorite Doctor Who stories in any medium because of its atmosphere. The music in this story is probably the best single music score that Doctor Who ever had on TV, old or new series. It is perfect. Every single choice, every single note is just exactly where it needs to be. Just the way you get these like deep bass notes every time like something ominous is happening. Like I still, to this day, I've seen this story so many times, and there are parts that still I involuntarily get chills watching it because it's just so like, you just feel like the walls closing in on you as you're watching this story. Like the first episode. Yeah. I mean, sure. They're just kind of running around inside the TARDIS, but like, the TARDIS cloisters, like we've never seen a room like this before. And now there's this like doom laden bell that echoes from somewhere within the ship that tells you that imminent disaster is nigh. And it's like, oh my, you know, we've never had anything like this in Doctor Who before. And we really don't ever have something like this again. And it just works so well. And like you said, Tom Baker's performance here is amazing. Like, obviously a lot of it is his actual emotion being communicated. I mean, we always wonder, you know, how much did he really want to leave the series? Because, you know, as the story goes, at the beginning of every season, near the end, he would go to the producer and be like, oh, I don't know, I think I should quit. And then they'd be like, oh no, Tom, you must stay, you know, here are your flowers and hosannas. And then he did that with JNT, and JNT's like, yeah, I think you're right. So, you know, he was, I'm sure, a little disappointed that, you know, he was actually, they called his bluff. But, I mean, from minute one of this story, the doctor knows he is going to die. Like, he knows something terrible is going to happen. And then, of course, once he talks to the watcher on the bridge, like, I think at that point he explicitly knows he's going to die. And so he's just very shut down, closed off. Like, he doesn't like making eye contact with anybody. He's, you know, he gets hostile towards the companions near the end. You know, he's forced into a partnership with the master. That episode three cliffhanger is awesome, by the way. Like, just the close-up of their hands connecting and then going into the credits as Tom, you know, is just, the master's this big grin on his face and Tom is just looking away in total disgust. Like, it's just, it's so well done. And then the regeneration sequence is, oh, I mean, between this and Androzani, I don't know which is the best of the classic series, but it's so good. I mean, it's over the top, and, you know, it like, do you need the, you know, flashbacks and all that? I don't know. I know Bidmead didn't like them. I love them. I think it works very well. There's so much emotion, like, tied into this regeneration that we just haven't had before. I mean, Pertwee came the closest because at least he got, you know, a tear Sarah Jane, but that was, you know, over in 30 seconds. Whereas here we get a whole, you know, few minutes at the end of the episode just dedicated to celebrating the outgoing doctor one more time. And you know, having the transformation into Peter Davison just feels like a rejuvenation. Like it really... It makes you want to watch Castrovalva right away and see where this thing is going, because it just works so well. And I know my colleague is about to follow me with a slightly less glowing review, but I understand that. But man, I absolutely love Legopolis.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. It's the thing that really sells the Legopolis is the atmosphere. Like, they just managed to create something that feels so doom-laden. And, you know, there are flaws with the story. It is slow. We've established all of this. But you can just feel it moving towards an absolute cataclysm. And I think by the end of the story, that cataclysm is far larger than what you'd actually expect. Like, we know the doctor's going, but hang on a minute, the master wipes out half the universe in the process. Cracking story. So go on, Jimmy, talk to us about Legopolis.
Yeah, I do enjoy this one, and I think overall it's quite good, but I definitely don't think I love it as much as you guys. But yeah, it's definitely got a great atmosphere, and the atmosphere really works well for it, and especially the new setup with the cloister room, that's brilliant set design. They did a really great job on that. And and especially, again, speaking of dark atmosphere, like you were saying earlier, the end of the third episode is just such a brilliant scene, and the Doctor basically denouncing his companions and saying he doesn't want them and turning to the Master and looking so utterly defeated. Tom does a brilliant job. Like, this, he could always be variable at times. The more, you know, some stories he's clearly phoning it in a bit because he's not enjoying it, but this is, he gives his best for his last story, and I think, yeah, absolutely does a brilliant job there. But, yeah, I think I'm a bit more aware of some of the flaws, because I think, firstly, the TARDISes, usually when they land, you sort of, occasionally people don't notice or whatever, but Legopolis really goes heavy with it. Like, every time the Master's TARDIS appears on Legopolis, like, everyone's formed this huge crowd of, oh, the Doctor's arrived, and looking at his TARDIS, and the Master's pot plant TARDIS appears behind them, and no one even bats an eyelid or turns around, and then appearing behind one of the Legopolitans right before he kills him. And it just, every time the Master's TARDIS appears, it's like no one's aware, but when the Doctor's appears, people usually notice. Well, then again, at the start, Tegan and her aunt don't notice it, but other than that, it's just, yeah, a bit weird there. And one thing that I found, the more you think about it, the worse it is, but it was kind of funny, is when the Master's got that little bracelet thing on Nyssa to control her, the dialogue is like, oh, I've got complete control of her hand, and yet when she's strangling Adric, she's just like, completely zoned out and fully doing it, and like you think, oh, it's okay, it's actually got control of her entirely. But then later, when he does, the master does his exposition about it and gets her to strangle the monitor, like the hand's going, but she's going like, oh no, no, and it's like, okay, so you can resist and say you don't want to kill the monitor, but when it's Adric, you do want to kill him. I mean, I'd understand if it was season 19, but
perfectly valid
here and now. but yeah, I do enjoy it despite those faults, and I do think though this, the reaction to Triacon being destroyed is a bit underplayed, but I think it sort of makes sense for her, so I can sort of excuse it. But yeah, it's a bit weird how the Watcher never really gets properly explained. Like, oh, he was the Doctor. Okay, how? And why is he able to appear and give himself advice to set up his own death? It's a bit weird, but yeah, I do enjoy it. But like, yeah, it's definitely got quite a few faults, and I don't think it's like a perfect end to the era. But overall, it does a good job. It's like, I don't hate it, I don't dislike it, but it's just not a favourite. It's good, but that's about it, really, I think.
Yeah, again, I can understand how this story doesn't click with everybody, because it's not quite doing as, it's not quite doing what Warrior's Gate does, but again, it's one that certainly needs watching a few times, and yeah. I think it's excellent, but then again, I've seen it about a million times. It's go-to Doctor Who for me. It's absolutely wonderful. I'm with Greg in, I think it's genuinely one of the best Doctor Who serials ever made. But it does build up to that massive regeneration, and it takes time, you know, with the regeneration. It actually takes its time to remind us as the audience kind of what we're losing in Tom Baker. And I know that it's not everybody's favourite, but I think it's great. I think, you know, we get to see clips going right back to Genesis of the Daleks, Revenge of the Cybermen. Some of the villains that are chosen for the sort of villains set of flashbacks are quite weird. You know, we've got Cybermen, the Daleks, the Master, the obvious one, but then kind of the captain from the pirate planet pops up, and all that kind of thing just seems a bit random. It's also a bit random that we use the Peter Pratt Master as opposed to the Jeffrey Beavers Master. Like, could we maybe have got Beavers to record something for that? I know it's not that simple, but that could have been something that I've looked at maybe. I don't know. But yeah, we take our time to say goodbye to the Fourth Doctor, and there is this real sense of rebirth afterwards, and it's, the whole season's felt like a real sense of rebirth. You know, it's so different to anything that came before, but it's almost like a crossover of eras. Season 18 kind of gets lost between being a Tom Baker season and a JNT 80s Doctor Who season. It just kind of, it doesn't quite sit into any era. Like, season 19 is very, very firmly the Fifth Doctor era. It's very, very firmly 80s Doctor Who. It's, there are no hangovers from the past. You know, we've actually got rid of the entire main cast from the 70s by season 19. Whereas 18, like, Tom is still there, Romana's still there, K-9's still there, and it just kind of, it's not quite hit the 80s yet. And I love it. I think it's so successful because it's kind of it's almost like a mesh of styles or a mesh of ideas, a mesh of atmospheres. And I'm really glad we have it. I'm really glad we have this sort of odd one out Tom Baker season. And I'm really glad that we don't have another season 17 as his final season. Or, you know, I'm really glad that we're not quite into season 19 yet, where the 80s have fully arrived. It's this sort of little, on sort of on the fence, I guess. So Tom's been a great Doctor. Every time I watch Legopolis, I do feel this enormous sense of, now I want more of this. I want more of 80s Tom Baker as Doctor Who. I just want more Tom Baker on screen as Doctor Who. And it feels like such a shame that he's got to go here. But it's such a good ending that I'm okay with it. And it is a great ending. It's a great regeneration. It's nice to have a bit more of an action-packed regeneration. You know, all the regenerations have been so far have been sort of, you know, in the TARDIS or in the unit lab, safe place, surrounded by friends. Whereas here, the Doctor's surrounded by two people who are near enough strangers, a friend he picked up in another universe not that long ago, and he's gone out because he's just fallen off a massive radio telescope while saving the entire universe. It's so different to any other regeneration that we've had so far, and arguably any regeneration we have since is like in the field, as it were, as opposed to the safe space of a regular set. So, Greg, one last time, let's talk about Tom Baker, the regeneration, whatever you want to. Go.
Oh, how do you do this? I mean, Tom is the, to this day, he's the definitive Doctor Who. Like that he, that is just a fact. He is still, to this day, decades later, over 40 years later, like people who are not even alive when he was on TV, and that includes me, still think of him when someone says Doctor Who, they think, oh yeah, the guy with the curly hair and the scarf. And part of that is because his performance is just so all-encompassing and so iconic, and part of it is because Tom himself is probably, well, easily, I should say, not probably, easily the most like his Doctor in real life. And he's just this absolute icon. And, you know, even though, you know, he's quite clearly defined by his role as the Fourth Doctor, you know, Tom is actually a pretty darn good actor. And, you know, he's the only Doctor Who actor that's ever been nominated for a Golden Globe. So, you know, this is not a joke here. Like, he's not, you know, just cruising along. And even though, you know, yeah, over time, like over the 7 years, there were, you know, he started feeling like he was the one in charge, and there were episodes that he was checked out of because he didn't like them and so forth. But when he wants to switch it on, like he's quite good, and you can see that, you know, in Legopolis. And like I think that you know, the final shot of him, like before the regeneration, where he flashes that, you know, famous grin one more time is just a beautiful, you know, beautiful thing. And that, I don't know if that was, you know, something that was suggested by the director, or if it was his idea or what, but like, that's just such a wonderful little note to put in right at the end. I mean, you got everything from him. You know, you got intensity, you got jollity, you got pretty much anything you wanted, you know, from the Doctor, you would see from Tom in his 7 years. And he was one of the few to really, you know, communicate to the audience just through his performance that this is an alien. This isn't, you know, an ordinary human like you and me. Like, this is a very powerful being from somewhere else. And I mean, he's not, you know, quote unquote, my Doctor. That's Sylvester McCoy. But I mean, if you ask me who my favorite Doctor is, I mean, how can you not say Tom? Like, I just don't, like, he's just the quintessential Doctor. And like you said, you know, you see this episode and you're like, I want another 7 seasons of this. And of course you don't get it, but man, like just a colossus standing astride the series. What a wonderful portrayal.
It's odd because, you know, Doctor Who was really, really well established. Like, Pertwee was excellent. Everybody loved every Doctor so far. Everybody loved Doctor Who. It's not like Doctor Who was this sort of struggling series waiting for Tom Baker to come along. He came along and he just enhanced something that was already really, really brilliant. And it's sort of hard to imagine sort of, you know, 1973-4 when there was no Tom Baker associated with Doctor Who. I can't imagine a time where he wasn't just so closely linked with the series as a whole. And yeah, he really did manage to create something wonderful in the Fourth Doctor. And we were so lucky to have him for so long as well. Jimmy, go ahead. Talk about the Fourth Doctor.
Yeah, he's a great incarnation, and it's nice to see how varied his era is, like the different styles, the different companions. That's the good thing about lasting so long. You don't get stuck with just, oh, this is what his era must be like. It's like you've got the follow-up to the Unit era with Robot, then you've got the Hinchcliffe horror, then you've got the more light-hearted Williams, then you've got more science season 18, and you've got such a good variety of companions to star against. And when he's putting his all into it, he's absolutely brilliant as the Doctor. I mean, yeah, sure, there are some times in some stories where he's clearly not as into it, but I think overall he works brilliantly most of the time, and I think that his era was just right. Like, I would have hated to see it be any shorter and to miss any of those dynamics, but I don't think it would have been as good if he kept going on further into the 80s. I think it just sort of, that 7 years was just the right length. Like, it just, everything worked out as it should. I'm really happy with the era he had. Like, most doctors, you think, oh, what might have happened if they stayed a bit longer? But Tom, it's like, you know, this is good. Like, you don't want to spoil it by dragging it on and on and on. I think, yeah, it just works as it is really well for me. I love his era, and it's been great to go through it all in order, because it had been a long time since I'd done that before coming back to it for this podcast. And, yeah, it was really great to get to see it all and see it from that perspective.
It's very much, I mean, the Fourth Doctor era, we refer to it as the Fourth Doctor era, it is very much three eras, you know, Philip Hinchcliffe, Graham Williams, and JNT all have very, very, very different ideas about what they wanted to do with Doctor Who. And Tom adapted to each of those styles very well. You know, Tom established his Doctor very quickly. By the end of season 12, he appears very, very, very comfortable in that role. And, you know, there were changes. And when the more comedic stuff came along in the Graham Williams era, you know, he did adapt to it. And, he proved he could do comedy. And he could do comedy incredibly well. And then season 18, he just snaps into this sort of more somber, serious mode. And I think season 18, he underplays an awful lot of it. You know, even through Legopolis, you know, we've got all of this about him not staring anybody in the eye, not everything seems really subtle. Everything seems underplayed, but it works so well. Like, he's not phoning it in. He's not making an effort. It's a conscious acting decision that just pays off so well. And I love the fact that, you know, if we were to look at the Fourth Doctor, he starts off sort of so alien and so full of life. And at some point, you know, his time traveling through time and space does make him a little bit of a cynic, and, you know, sort of brings him down a bit for that final season. I like to think there's a huge gap between seasons 17 and 18. I like to think there's a million unseen adventures with the Doctor and Romana and K-9, which, you know, works perfectly fine in terms of sort of character's age, continuity, however you want to fill that gap in. You know, they could have travelled together for centuries. And it's a nice thought that they do, but obviously something happens to the Doctor in that time that kind of changes his outlook on the universe. And then obviously you've got the awareness of his impending death, which, you know, we don't really see him know that until, as Greg pointed out before, the start of Legopolis. But you almost get a hint that he can feel it, or you know something's coming, which again just changes his persona slightly for this last season. No matter what, though, I love the way he plays the Doctor in season 18. It's kind of not the obvious choice to go for. There's nothing in any of the stories that suggest Tom needs to be a bit more somber, a bit more moody. It's obviously a choice he's made. And I think it works really, really well. I really do think we get this sort of older, tireder, slightly more moody Fourth Doctor. And there were still some great lighthearted moments in season 18. You know, I mentioned it when we were doing the first half, the whole arrest the scarf bit in Leisure Hive's just fantastic, and you know, Megloss is wonderful, and the way the Doctor sort of plays the way Tom plays the Doctor there is slightly different. But yeah, he definitely adapted to the changes that were going on behind the scenes incredibly well, and I think that's what makes him such a great Doctor. You know, we know that Hartnell didn't adapt particularly well to a new producer. We know that Troughton got really annoyed with the sort of musical chairs of script editors and producers in his era. Pertwee was lucky. He had a pretty consistent production team, bar his first couple of stories. And, you know, same again later on. Peter Davison has a consistent production team. Colin Baker does for all but a few episodes. And so does Sylvester McCoy. No other Doctor has been asked to adapt to the way the show changes like Tom Baker, and each time Tom Baker had to adapt, he did it absolutely brilliantly. And I think that's sort of his greatest testament. The Tom Baker era is not one era. It's a series of absolutely fantastic eras that Tom Baker is the only thing that glues together. And I think that's just one thing, one of many things that makes this era so loved and just keeps him so closely associated with the series. But yeah, it's been great to go through Tom Baker era. It's been great to go through season 18 as well. Opening up the floor for any final thoughts before we sign off, if you'd like to jump in with anything else.
I don't really have much. I mean, I think we've said it all here. I think, you know, it's the end of the, you know, like you said, it's the end of three different eras in a way, and it's the end of just a legendary run in Doctor Who. And I mean, I'm very excited to move forward into the Fifth Doctor's era, but yeah, I mean, there's just something about the Tom Baker era that the show just didn't recapture, you know, before or since, for whatever reason, and I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, me too, actually. Like, I'm really excited to sort of get on with the 80s doing these season by season. You know, we've still got some absolutely great seasons coming. I'm really looking forward to talking about season 21, I think, is absolutely great. I'm really looking forward to us looking at 22 and sort of figuring out, did it go wrong here, or is it just perception, or was it just BBC, you know, all that kind of thing. Trial will be interesting to talk about. Seasons 25 and 26 are absolutely exceptional. We've got some really good stuff to talk about still, but it's not time.
And Time Lash.
Oh, we're doing that? I thought we were just going to skip it. I thought we were just going to pretend season 21 ended with Caves of Androzani, and season 22 just didn't have Time Lash in it. I suppose we better hand cover everything, really, hadn't we? Ow. Until then, though, we will leave it there. So we'll be back to talk about more Doctor Who, specifically season 19, in the not-too-distant future. And, you know, we're picking up on the trilogy that we've done the first two-thirds of with that as well, so it'll be kind of interesting to talk about the continuation from Legopolis there too. But in the meantime, I will say a huge thank you and goodbye to Greg.
Until next time.
And a huge thank you and goodbye to Jimmy.
Thanks, and I can't wait to get on to the Fifth Doctor soon.
So it is the end of this episode of a podcast of Spurious Morality, but
The moment has been prepared for.
I was going to say like 1, 2, 3 and get us all to say it together, but no, we'll take that.
I got in too soon, sorry.
The moment has indeed been prepared for.
You were just waiting the whole episode to get that out, so I appreciate it.
I had. It's almost like the moment of being prepared. I'm going to stop now. So goodbye, thank you for listening, and we'll be back for more Spodcasting soon.